Hello, pod people of the planet. This is Material World, a used-to-be 28-minute, but for the next 6 months, 25-minute slab of science and such like from the BBC with me, Quentin Cooper. For terms and conditions of use, that's the programme's terms and conditions, not mine, go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. As Guy de Maupassant once said, I got the music in me. Actually, come to think of it, it might have been Kiki D rather than Kinky Gee, but whoever it was, we'll go from noise to ear to brain to look at how we get the music and other sounds in us and are able to process and mimic what we hear. That's after celebrating the plastic that first turned heads and hips as something, you know, for kids. It's 50 years since the hula hoop was created and became a globe-encircling craze, and the hoop itself was only able to achieve mass popularity thanks to something which, as of 2008, has been with us in many commercial forms for exactly 75 years. Polythene. Until the Wham-O toy company used circular tubes of polythene to make their hula hoops, the market for the hard to tightly quality controlled plastic had seemed limited. But with sales peaking at over 6 million hoops a month in 1958, polythene suddenly became a manufacturing mainstay, and so it's remained. The fad for hoolering may have spun out of steam, although there has been something of a revival of late, but in excess of 50 million tonnes of other polythene products are still produced each year. To explore the many ways it's shaped and wrapped our world over the last 75 years, I'm joined by Jeff Mitchell, Professor of Polymer Physics at Reading University, and Dame Julia Higgins, Professor of Polymer Science at Imperial College London. Julia Higgins, can we start by making sure of our nomenclature? Polythene, polyethylene, I think I've even seen polyethene.
I think technically a chemist would say it's polyethene because the systematic name of the molecule which is polymerised is ethene. But
right.
You don't often call it that.
No.
Polyethylene was the name it was given when it was first discovered, but polythene, I think, was the brand name that ICI gave it, and that's the name we all know it by, and that's the name we refer to it, but it's not a chemical systematic name.
So really, even what chemists call polyethene, does that equal what the public think of polythene, or are some things that we call polythene not polyethene?
No, I think they're all polyethene, but what the public doesn't know is that you knit together lots of ethene units and you produce CH2 millions of times. But by changing the structure, you produce lots of different materials with different properties. So when people think polythene, they probably think of the nearest plastic bag. They should remember there are lots of different forms of it.
Right. So the chemical building blocks, if you like, might be the same, but what you construct from it may be quite radically different.
Okay, yep.
I think we've got that right. Jeff Mitchell, when you've got something as ubiquitous as polythene or polyethene, let's just call it polythene, shall we? It's hard to think of it as having a single point of origin. But so what was it that happened 75 years ago?
Yeah. Well, we're just a few days away from the weekend when, on the Friday, Fawcett and Gibson carried out some experiments at high pressure with some particular chemicals, came back on the Monday after the weekend, probably had a lovely weekend in Cheshire, opened up their high-pressure apparatus and discovered a white waxy solid, which subsequent analysis showed that it was consisted only of CH2s, of the ethylene repeating unit. And that was the start of 75 years of really very involved science and technology to make the materials that we have available to us today.
Bit of a leap, though, from a white, waxy substance that you've made at high pressure to think, oh, you know, this has a plethora of uses.
Yes. Well, it took quite a lot of guts from the ICI management at the time, because on the basis of a few grams that had been extracted from this apparatus, they committed quite a large-scale programme to develop it on the sort of tonne scale. So that was quite a leap of faith there. The materials that have come from that over the years, as Julia said, are just different ways of knitting together those CH2 units. So we have a variety of materials that all started from just one way of knitting them together, but we now have many ways of linking them together in these chemical reactions.
So, Julia, it's like there's a second level to this, isn't it? The credit goes to the people who discover, but also to actually realise very slowly there probably is no individual you can point to, but, oh, this will work with this, and if we do this, this will work with this. Very gradually, polythene has spread out across the world in countless applications.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, it's the clever chemists. What they did was to produce different catalysts that would actually make the polythene grow in a single straight line, linear polyethylene, with little short branches off it, which is low-branched polyethylene, with long branches off it, with lots of long branches off it. Each one of those had different properties. I've got here two plastic bags from supermarkets. You're sort of familiar with that noise. This is also a polythene bag. It makes a very different noise.
Right.
They're different forms of the polythene.
This is really exciting the sound scientists from the second half of the programme, by the way. Right.
and simply due to the way whether the one of them is making rather more crystals because it's more linear. The other one is making fewer crystals because it's got lots of branches and the branches can't get into the crystals. But that produces lots of different properties. And of course, it's much more important when you get into engineering applications. Plastic bags, it's more a question of the fashion, whether you want a crunchy plastic bag or a soft plastic bag. But when you want to use it in high-tech engineering applications, it matters very much what sort of branching structure you've got.
Is it slightly frustrating from the polymer scientist's point of view that, you know, to the public, it's just a plastic bag and this is just plastic and we treat it in such a kind of casual, throwaway way and yet there's all this science, all these applications, all this ingenuity?
Yeah, it is actually. It's the simplest possible molecule, polymer molecule you could make. You can't make anything simpler than CH2, CH2 to the end of the world. And yet you can make all these different things with it. All your hip implants have got ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene in them, for example. Lots of engineering applications, screws and caps and things. All the milk bottles in your fridge are in polythene. There's right. ranges and ranges of things we do.
I stress when Julie says your hip plants to me, she is speaking figuratively here. So also, I mean, what about this point, just briefly? There was clearly this point when the hula hoop came along, when there were still problems in manufacturing it. So there were difficulties to be overcome before we got this bulk project.
It's very much the 75 years has been about introducing control. So what we're able to do now is to control the sorts of branching, the linearisation that Julia mentioned, extremely well. Whereas in the early 50s, when Philips company and other people were developing catalysts to do this, to generate this, they didn't have very good control. And so there was a lot of variability in it. And therefore, the material could only be used for fairly low-grade products so that in 1950s, it could be used for the hula hoop, whereas now it's used for strapping down goods in the space shuttle. It's used for tethering astronauts to the space shuttle when they're doing spacewalks. So that's the sort of part of that journey which has come from chemists providing control and engineers learning how to process the material. From all of that control has come a huge shift in the product range from hula hoops to space ropes.
No, I mean, I presume I would be in dangerous territory if I asked it, name me some modern uses, because I imagine if you looked around this studio, you could find 100 things made from partly from polythene.
Well, of course, now all electrical cables are based on polyethylene in terms of the insulation, so that makes us safe. The water doesn't come in lead pipes anymore, because that wasn't safe. They now come in polyethylene pipes. Packaging keeps lots of things safe, keeps bugs away, keeps food fresh. Different applications of that sort.
But Julia, we're hearing a lot of positives here, but isn't there a dark side to this 75-year legacy? You know, all those 50 million tonnes of polythene that are being produced each year, they all get clogged up somewhere, usually in landfills. There's a lot of moves recently, Alistair Darling's budget to say we're going to have to pay for plastic bags. Places like Ireland, where you already do, some countries have completely banned them. I think in Britain we get through 8 billion bags a year. There must be some way to change all this, or is this just the other side of the coin?
I think we have to be careful. If you actually ask, well, what would you be using if you weren't using a polythene bag? You'd be using paper, you'd be using Hessian, you'd be using something else. They're not altogether ecologically friendly.
But isn't there, kind of a leap in there, but isn't there a psychological component? It's not to say necessarily you need something to replace the polythene bag, but isn't it partly because it's so cheap that we do not put enough value on it to reuse our polythene bags?
I think that's true. I'm not sure. I mean, clearly we can reuse it several times to go to the supermarket. My own view, and I think it's a view of quite a lot of people, is it ought to be part of the waste, the domestic waste, and domestic waste ought to be incinerated safely. I mean, putting things in landfill is totally wrong. We're going to fill up all the landfill. It's terribly wasteful and we need sources of energy. But actually, safe incineration is something that people haven't been paying an awful lot of attention to, and it's something that's going to have attention paid to it. And then the polythene bags are actually quite a useful form of as it were, oil. It's not oil, but it's going to help the waste to burn, so it's quite useful. My own view is that the polythene bag problem is actually just a symptom of our terrible attitude to waste. We don't handle waste very well.
Jeff, I think out of the corner of my eye I caught your brow furrowing at the mention of incineration.
No, not at all. I was only thinking that another aspect of it is over those 75 years, not only have we learned how to control putting CH2 units together to make polyethylene, but we've also learned about how making other materials. And there are other approaches that which will develop over the years. So, for example, there's a polymer that's based on polylactide, which is a material that can be made from natural products. There are ways of incorporating starch into plastic bags, and these are already widely available. You can now buy bags you'd put into your kitchen waste, which you can put directly into the compost because it will break down as part of the composting process. So in actual fact, there's quite a family of products available, and I think the focus is just on this one particular sort of plastic bag when there are many sorts of plastic bags, and some of it is about using the right material for the right function.
So finally, Jeff, can you see us getting to an age where maybe in 25, 50 years where polythene, or at least as we think of it now, is a material mostly of the past rather than of the present and the future?
Goodness me, the world runs on polyethylene at the moment, so it's very difficult to see how we will be able to replace every one of those functions with other sorts of materials. It will be a mainstay for many years to come.
OK, Professors Jeff Mitchell, Julia Higgins, there we'll have to bring things to an extrusion. Thank you both. On to a different kind of plasticity in a moment, but more on the extruded plastic dingus, a.k.a. Frisbee, and other forms of polythene can be found via our web pages at bbc.co.uk/radio4, along with a whole heap of past programmes to be listened to as and when the mood takes you. I've got two to catch up with myself, plus the chance to join the merry gang who've already signed up for our free podcast and details of how to write in should the urge come upon you. Now, listen to this as best you're able.
Imagine that you stretch a pillowcase tightly across the opening of a bucket, and different people throw ping-pong balls from different distances. Each person can throw as many ping-pong balls as he likes, as often as he likes. Your job is to figure out, just by looking at how the pillowcase moves up and down, how many people there are, who they are, and whether they're walking towards you, away from you, or are standing still.
Music producer-turned-neuroscientist Daniel Levitin's analogy for how hearing works and how incredible it is that it works. Another example from recent research consists of playing a snatch of Monty Python. One clip sounds normal, the next clip sounds really much the same, but the real surprise is that all of it turns out to be backwards. You get it by getting the original, chopping it into very short chunks of a few milliseconds, reversing each bit, then sticking them all back together, and yet it remains easy to understand. So, what's going on? Well, those clips are part of the ongoing research into how we process sound by unicycling neuroscientist Dr. Jan Schnupp at Oxford, who joins us, as does Sophie Scott, Professor of Neuroscience at University College London, who's working with an impressionist to see which parts of the brain are used when we recall accents or try to mimic someone. Jan Schnupp, I have to get this question out of the way first, but when I go to your webpage, first thing I see is a picture of you in a cape on a unicycle. You do work involving clips from Monty Python and ferrets. Do you have any problems getting your research taken seriously?
Usually not, no. I think by and large people are happy to see that serious scientists can have a sense of humour, and if they doubt my seriousness, I physically assault them with a mathematical equation.
Good answer. OK, so let's break this down. We're dealing with a really complicated phenomenon, talking, listening, understanding. First bit, I'm talking to you now. How does that get from my mouth to your ear?
Well, I think that, you know, often when people are first introduced to hearing, they're said that they need to think about this in terms of sound waves. But the waves is actually not really what we're interested in. What we're interested in is the objects around us, and the objects around us, they vibrate, and that's what makes the sound. And the sound really only just provides a sort of coupling between the vibrating object and the ear. You know, you can, if you have a balloon, for example, and you squeeze a balloon, you can see that the air inside it is somewhat springy. The springiness of the air is something that we're not aware of unless we've got air trapped in a balloon or something. But it's that springiness that allows there to be a coupling, a physical coupling between vibrating objects around us.
And okay, it is the medium which can carry the sound across to our ear, where presumably something else vibrates. Okay, can I get you, Sophie Scott, to pick up the story there? So the sound has reached my eardrum? What happens after that?
Absolutely. And there, because it's a movement, as Jan says, it needs to be turned into something electrical that the brain can deal with. So in the cochlea, in the mechanisms of the cochlea, you basically have, and the rest of the ear, ways of turning those vibrations into electrical impulses, which are then sent up what's called the ascending auditory part pathway. So these like relay stations that process different aspects of the sound until you've got something up at the brain level.
But there are actually, I mean, we tend to think of things in a more static way, but there are actual moving parts here, aren't there, which actually help almost like a system of gears change the sound into something we can process.
Absolutely. And it's in this way, it's very unlike vision. Your ear is taking these vibrations in the air and it's moving them literally by the air vibrations are moving these little bones in your ear, and then that vibration is passed on in the cochlea, where you have hair cells which move up and down to the movements of the wave in the cochlea, which come from the sound. And that's what's actually turning the sound into an electrical energy that the brain can hear.
Yeah, and this sounds fine when you're talking about a single source of sound is a nice simple illustration, but aren't we being swamped by sounds most of the time? I'd imagine even in the dead of night there's all sorts of vibrations going on, and don't we have to filter through these and somehow sort out, you know, at the same time lots of different things are going on, which are the ones we want to concentrate on?
Yes, I mean, that is, to be quite honest, if I truly understood how this sort of separating out of different sound sources worked, I'd book my ticket to Stockholm and go and collect my Nobel Prize.
You could afford a whole bicycle.
Exactly, I'd be able to put my front wheel. But, we are beginning to have some ideas of how this might work. And I think we are becoming increasingly aware, of course, that what is important in order to be able to do this is as much experience and top-down influences in the from the brain as there is bottom-up ones. You see, I mean, what we've just heard Sophie describe is this sort of ascending pathway that takes the vibrations in and pushes them up into our brain through these, we can basically think of the auditory nerve like wires. But of course, then these sound waves are matched up against our expectations of what we might hear. And these expectations can, they can be shaped by the environment that we're in. So that allows us to, if we know that there is an engine running, then we can know that, and we can recognize the repeatability of the engine sound, and we can then filter that out.
And even if it changes gear, that will be something we'll be almost anticipating, because that would be within our range of expected noises.
Absolutely.
I mean, Sophie, I think I've got an example of this, because I'm just back from my holes, and in one hotel I went in, I was put into a room way up high in the hotel, and I'd just been in there. And I heard a very what seemed strange noise outside the window, and it was literally after a couple of seconds I pattern matched it and thought, I think there must be a pool down below where my hotel is, and somebody has just dived into it. And indeed, I looked out the window, and there was a pool. And I wondered if that was a sort of slow motion version of what we're doing most of the time.
I think it is. One of the really interesting things about sound is that whenever you hear a sound, it means something's happened, a physical action has occurred somewhere. Mm. So kind of encoded in those vibrations are properties of the action and the body that the action happened into. So probably you'd hear a different kind of splash if a piano fell into the swimming pool than if somebody had dived in, but you'd still hear a splash. So your brain's also able to kind of decode this information about the nature of the action. We hear sound as an action as well as a sound.
Yes, I don't think I'd be able to tell if it was somebody on a unicycle going into the pool. It was just a vague pool sort of noise. Yeah, and this is clearly a huge area, because we're talking about all these different factors, all these things, but I'm determined to get onto your ferrets. So how do they come into this?
The ferrets are fantastic animals to use to study auditory perception.
You don't hear a lot about ferrets in science, I have to say.
Well, they are becoming increasingly popular, it must be said. They have a large number of advantages. I mean, for example, they hear rather well. I mean, that's right. Unlike mice, for example. Mice are very popular animals in science because they're very easy to breed, they're cheap to maintain, and you've got a huge amount of choice of different animals. But mice, for example, they only hear ultrasound. They hear no sounds below 4 kilohertz.
So that finally explains that experiment where somebody grafted an ear onto the back of a mouse.
That was more for spare parts.
No, I'm joking.
So a mouse wouldn't be able to, for example, if you were to talk on the telephone to a mouse, the mouse wouldn't hear anything, because all the frequencies that are transmitted through a telephone actually are below the audible range of a mouse.
Well, I think we've reached our quota of surreal for this program.
Exactly. whereas a ferret has an auditory range that overlaps very much with the human auditory range. They've got a good sensitivity, and they're very easily trained. So you can actually train them on different tasks. If you hear a high-pitched sound, go left. If you hear a low-pitched sound, go right. And they will learn this task very happily, and you can find out how well they can distinguish certain sounds. And then you can record from their brain cells and work out how they do it.
And what have you found?
Oh, many things. I mean, for example, we found that the clip that you played earlier with a time reversal, where you had 20 millisecond long chunks that were time reversed, that if you were to decode neural patterns at the cortical level, you need to decode them at a 20 millisecond sort of time chunking time windows in order to be able to read the cortical code, in order to be able to say, you know, what is this animal actually listening to? Try to infer what they were listening to just from recording their
brain activity. But you can't play Monty Python to ferrets, can you? They're not going to know what's going on.
Why? Well, they don't have to know what's going on, but I mean, you can still ask, you know, could they tell whether it's forward or backward, or could they tell it's, you know... I mean, this is not something that we have done, but there's other researchers, for example, who've managed to train animals on telling whether somebody speaks Japanese or Dutch. You know, you might be interested in finding out, you know, where that sort of very high level of processing happens. You know, I mean, I think it's probably too high for my level. I mean, what I'm really interested in is things like object recognition. I mean, how do we go from a sound wave to recognizing?
And it's also about the units of time, isn't it? Because one thing it's worth saying is that we had these little 20 millisecond chunks in the piece we heard reverse. But if you have a larger chunk and you reverse it, then suddenly it becomes incomprehensible.
It becomes completely incomprehensible. So it's interesting to ask, what is magic about these 20 milliseconds? And in that respect, of course, it's interesting to bear in mind that in vision we have a similar phenomenon. I mean, if you watch a television screen, the television screen is actually made up of lots of static images that are refreshed, you know, in order to give us the idea of a continuously moving image. And this refresh rate is also in the order of 20 milliseconds.
Okay. Now, Sophie, why did you end up using an impressionist? And please don't say because Jan had taken all the ferrets.
It's because I'm really interested in how our brains deal with speech, both getting the speech in and getting the speech out, and how those two things actually interact, because the way that we learn to speak completely influences the sounds we can hear. And the two, speech perception and speech production, are really linked in our brains. And I thought it'd be really fun and interesting to work with a professional voice artist, and I work with a guy called Duncan Wisby, who can really change his voice, change it so much that if I can't see him, I wouldn't necessarily know it was him, and do different accents and do different people. And how's he actually doing that? Because all of us, when we talk in different registers at different times. I'm speaking differently now than I might do if I was trying to stop my child from running into the road.
I should hope so.
And, you know, you could tell if I was in a really bad mood or not, or if I was ill. That's all these things are changing. But these voice artists are really kind of exceptionally skilled artists in really controlling these properties. So what's actually going on in their brains when they change their voice, when they sound like someone different?
And?
Well, interestingly, what we find is that, I mean, and so far we have only scanned Duncan, but when he's doing an impersonation of somebody or he's doing an accent, we actually see very similar activations. And they're kind of mostly outside the areas of the brain which are to do with speech production per se, which is quite interesting. He gets very strong activation in a part of the brain called the intraparietal sulcus, which is very involved in overt visual imagery. So if I ask you to think of a number 8, turn it on its side, does that look like a pair of glasses? When you do that you really strongly activate the intraparietal sulcus.
Right.
Another brain area he really activates is the sensory motor strip, which is sort of the area associated with really direct control of gesture. But he's activating the parts over and above the ones associated with the face and voice. He's activating the parts that would be associated with head movement and arm movement and body movement. So even though he wasn't moving in the scanner, he was thinking about how the people actually kind of hold themselves and how they move to actually impersonate them. And then we did get some brain areas to do with speech production activated, the supplementary motor area, much, much associated with vocalizations. But it was even more activated than when he just speaks normally.
And presumably you could extend this logically to see the difference between a good impressionist and a bad impressionist, because they maybe don't do all this visual stuff as well.
Absolutely. It would be really interesting to know if this is a sort of a common system that people use to effect these changes, or if it might depend on exactly the strategies you use. If you use a much more analytic way of doing it, for example, I mean, and I'm here basing this on how Duncan describes what he does. Sometimes he says he really imagines he's getting into somebody's skin, and there you can sort of see these issues of visual imagery and thinking about somebody's body to do it. Does everybody do it in that sense? Way.
And presumably the longer implications of this as to whether there are degrees of plasticity. Is it the people who've got the most plasticity in their brains who are able to be impressionists?
Absolutely. And does that have kind of implications for how we can think about helping people? I mean, there's a condition called foreign accent syndrome that I've worked with for a while, where people have generally quite a small stroke and they can still talk afterwards, but they talk with a completely different accent. They sound very different to how they did originally. And this seems to, they basically got a very different sound to them. Can we help them think about different ways of changing their voices?
Okay, more on that next time. I hope Professor Sophie Scott, Dr. Jan Schnupp, many thanks. You've passed the audition. Next week, we're in Edinburgh for its annual science festival, where we'll be inspectors of the vectors of Hector, the new national supercomputer. Hector stands for high-end computing something, 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 and is capable of 63 million calculations a second. But the hard for even Hector to answer question is just what all that computational power should best be used for.